Because the Muslim armies begin to move out of Arabia into Persia, and that would, of course, be taking areas today which we would call Syria and Lebanon, Iraq and Iran. And then the Muslim army also moves out across northern Africa, takes all of northern Africa, takes Spain, becomes Moorish Spain, and if it were not for the defeat of the Muslim army in the hands of Charles Martel, might have taken most of Europe. Later on, they once again try to come in and are defeated at the gates of Austria in September 11th, a date that was picked intentionally by one of our Islam leaders. We'll talk about more in just a minute. But if you look at Islam today, this shows you Islam, and that is most Muslims, about 80 to 85% of Muslims would be Sunni Muslims. Those would be in the light green up there. Then you have some that are Shiite Muslims. Those would be in the dark green, which are primarily in the southern part of Iraq and then, of course, in Iran. The most dominant Shia Muslim country in the world is Iran. And if you think about this in terms of missions, ever heard of the 1040 window? Let me superimpose the 1040 window. You can see that one of the great challenges for missions today in the 21st century is Islam. You know, what are we going to do to reach out to those countries? And you recognize we have a lot of our friends that go underground and in covert ways into some of these countries because this is the only way really to advance missions in these very challenging areas. What do Muslims believe? Well, that is pretty simple. And again, you can see in the handout, we'll talk briefly about this. Every Muslim in the world, whether they are Shiite or Sunni or Sufi or whatever they might be, almost all of them hold to what are called the five pillars of Islam. What are the five pillars? Very simple. The first one is the Shahada. That is the creed. There is no God but Allah and Muhammad is his prophet. If you go to a mosque even here in North Texas and you'll hear the call to worship, you will hear those words. If you are born, you will hear those words. If you are dying, they will whisper those words into your ear as you are dying. And you will say those many times each day. Second of all, prayers. How many times do Muslims pray every day? Five times, right? Now, some Sufis pray three, but most Muslims will pray five times a day. And this is to remind you of the fact that you need to be in devotion to Allah. Then they have the almsgiving. They are to give 1/20th or 5% of their income to the advancement of Islam. The fast of Ramadan, we just finished that recently. It happens during the 9th lunar month. And you fast from sunrise to sunset. And then the final one is the pilgrimage of the Hajj. That is, every able-bodied Muslim is to go to Mecca, surround the Kaaba. And the Kaaba is a dark stone that came from the sky, they say. Many people believe it was a meteorite. And many of those practices, which interestingly enough, existed before Muhammad established the religion of Islam, still take place. In a few minutes, I'm going to talk about the fact that the ISIS group, even though they're Sunni Muslims, want to go in and destroy all of what is in Mecca. So there is an interesting kind of mindset here, which I'll explain more about in just a minute. But these are what are called the five pillars of Islam. But if that's all you knew, you would say, well, then how do I explain Islamic Jihad? How would I explain ISIS? How would I explain Al-Qaeda? That's because some people say that there are not five pillars of Islam. There is a sixth pillar of Islam, which is what? Jihad. Now, if you were to get a Quran that's in the English, oftentimes it will be translated struggle or to strive. And so this, in some cases, in some Muslim words, are actually illustrating the idea of struggling to conform my will to the will of Allah. So sometimes you'll see words like jihad. Even right now, they have, in Iran, they have the Minister of Jihad, but it's dealing with agriculture. So obviously it's not talking about killing people. So jihad can have other meanings. But I think the more normal understanding, of course, is a physical action. And the more literal fundamentalist or Islamist Muslims hold to that as well. A lot of what Islam is about relates to the two major books. The one, of course, is the Quran, which is a little bit thinner, about the same size as maybe our New Testament. Has 114 surahs, or what you might call chapters. Most of those are surahs that were written in Mecca. Some were written in Medina, and the Medina surahs are the ones where you have a lot of the words about jihad and going out and slay and to kill and other things. But in addition to that, there are things that guide a typical Muslim, and those are found in what is known as the Hadith. The Hadith is a collection of sayings of Muhammad. And really, in a sense, it helps you understand the lifestyle of many Muslims. For example, you might ask a Muslim, why is it you put your pants on when you're sitting down? Because it's recorded in the Hadith that Muhammad put on his pants when he stepped down, when he was sitting down. Why is it you wrap your turban while you stand? Because it's recorded in the Hadith that Muhammad wrapped his turban while he stood. These are all, in a sense, guiding how you eat, what you eat, when you eat, how you fast, even sexual relations, all sorts of things are all guided in large part by the Hadith and how the various imams or caliphs actually interpret those and apply that in terms of Sharia law. In terms of the major divisions, we're going to talk more about this in just a minute when we get into ISIS, but you have to say that most Muslims tend to be Sunni Muslims. The Muslims you find in Saudi Arabia, in Egypt, in Turkey, they all follow what is known as the Sunnah or the practice of Muhammad. Remember those bracelets people used to wear, WWJD? Well, there's a sort of WWMD, what would Muhammad do? And so, in a sense, they follow the practice of Muhammad. But there are some Muslims, the Shiite Muslims, which actually split off early on. By the time you had the fourth leader of Islam, the fourth caliph, you had those who said, no, the leader of Islam needs to have a direct lineage back to Muhammad. And so they began to follow Ali. And so you find these primarily in southern Iraq and Iran. If ISIS meets anybody that's a Shiite Muslim, they kill them instantaneously because they're all seen as heretics. As I've said before, one of the greatest threats to a Muslim today is another Muslim, especially when you talk about these divisions here. And then also, there are fewer and fewer of them left, but there were certainly a very large group of other Muslims known as Sufi Muslims. These would be your Persians. And these were the ones primarily from which you got all the stories of the flying carpets and of genies or jinn and Aladdin, and all that comes from the Sufis as well. So those are three major divisions. But let's, if we can, then move to what is happening with ISIS and a little bit of its history. I'm seeing more and more people say that maybe one of the greatest threats we face today is the threat from ISIS. And it's a really important question. What are we going to do? And certainly as Christians, I think we can pray and we can give. But I think it also is relevant when we talk about this presidential election. August 6th, you might mark that calendar, there's a presidential debate. And I'm hoping that in addition to talking about everything from Planned Parenthood to immigration and same-sex marriage, they also talk about this. Because I think it's one of the most existential threats we will have faced, and certainly what our Christians are facing there in the Middle East right now. So when we talk about this, ISIS was once known as Al-Qaeda in Iraq. ISIS used to simply be part of Al-Qaeda. Some of you will see that it's called ISIL. Our president wants to call that, whereas the final S is usually Syria. He says that final one should be the letter L for Levant, which was kind of the British term for that region of the world. They're referring to the same thing, essentially. But ISIS was so brutal because of some of the disagreement between a man I will show you in just a minute, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, and Zarqawi, Abu Zarqawi. They actually split away. Al-Qaeda actually considered the followers of ISIS too brutal, which tells you a lot about ISIS, doesn't it? And so, of course, it has now become the richest terrorist group in the history of the world. Because as they take over, and you heard today Johnny Moore talk a little bit about taking over the armaments there in Mosul, but also as they take over the oil fields, they are reaping tremendous amount of money. As they come into a community, they take over all the money in the bank, and they have just a very sophisticated operation. They now, because of taking over some of those armaments, have more firepower than any jihadist organization. And they could no longer be called the JV group, I think. This is one that is, I think, a lot more dangerous than you might say. And you can see that in terms of the control of the territory, we are talking about controlling a vast portions of Syria, virtually all of eastern Syria. They control most of Iraq, and if it were not for the Kurds up there, and that's Erbil up there in Kirkuk, that would be taken over. If it were not for the Peshmerga, who are the fighters in the Kurdish area, they would have taken most of that. They've moved down. Of course, you heard Johnny talking about Mosul, which is up there in the top, which is, of course, also known as Nineveh. You can even see that on the map, all the way down to Fallujah. And you can see that they control more land area than many of the Western democracies. So we're talking about something that is a very significant threat indeed. To give you one illustration, this comes from Eric Stickelback's book. He says, just think about how ISIS controlled and dominated the region simply when they came into Mosul and they were able to take over the dam in Mosul. The Mosul Dam, they were able to take over in August of last year, so just a year ago. This was a dam that was built by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. Once they controlled the dam, they controlled an enormous amount of real estate, and they had the ability to threaten so many without having to do anything else. Because, first of all, that held back 11 billion cubic meters of water, so they began to reduce the water supply and began to starve Fallujah and Baghdad and others. So now they control the water supply. They produced, you know, all that electricity, so then they could cut back on the electricity. And you just heard about some of those living in a place where they only had 1 hour of electricity a day. And some people said if they blew up the dam, which they might have done, they would have sent a 60-foot wave of water downstream, which would have killed hundreds and thousands of Iraqis. So just controlling the dam itself put them in a very powerful position. The good news, we were able to drive them somewhat back from the dam, but the bottom line is that's just an illustration of how just taking one piece of real estate can have such a devastating impact on the rest of the country. Johnny mentioned that symbol. Have you seen this symbol? Perhaps if you're on Facebook from time to time, you'll see some Christians there. Because as ISIS troops have gone into a community, first of all, they've slaughtered Jews and Christians. Yazidis, those are those who are kind of an offshoot of Islam that existed kind of in that area, the Kurdish region. Alawites, who are a very peaceful group of Muslims, as well as Shiite Muslims and all the rest. But they would go in and they would mark the various homes with this letter N. This is the Arabic letter N. And it reminds me a lot of, remember when the Nazis would come in and would mark the homes with the Star of David? Here they will mark it with the N and establish that this is a Christian home. And either will destroy it, take it over, sometimes kill the people that are there. Their actions, of course, Johnny Moore talked a little bit about that. Sold women as sex slaves, they beheaded men and women, captured and burned all sorts of people. Their influence, of course, more brutal than Al-Qaeda, and of course, more firepower. New York Times the other day recorded that they're the world's richest terrorist group with hundreds of millions of dollars. So we can't minimize its impact any longer. If you want to understand a little bit of its history, I think the best book on that is a book by Charles Dyer and Moody, and this is a Moody Press book. He talks about really five dots that you have to connect. And last time I spoke on this, I think back in May, I mentioned just a few of those. Let me go into a little more detail because it helps you understand how did we get here? How did ISIS take over so quickly? And what was preceding this? And the sad reality is even when the mainstream press covers ISIS, they don't give you the historical context. So for a couple minutes, would you let me kind of go through the history just to help you get an understanding of how we ended up here? And he says the first dot is to recognize, and those of you that have gray hair or no hair at all, you can remember this, but the younger kids, they don't remember any of this. Back in the 1970s, remember when Russia came into Afghanistan? Remember when that happened? And then Jimmy Carter said we would not participate in the Olympics and all of the things that happened unfolded there. Well, those who were fighting Russia were the Mujahideen. And over time, not officially, but unofficially, there were individuals that helped arm the Mujahideen. Matter of fact, there was a Rambo. Was it Rambo 3, I think it was, or something like that, you know, that actually had him fighting there. But one of the leaders of the Mujahideen is what? Osama bin Laden. So you begin to see even there the beginning of Al-Qaeda. Well, then after Russia left, there was this incredible power vacuum. And those students who were Muslim students who had actually been in Pakistan actually came in and took power. And they had studied, and Taliban means students. They were the students of a radical form of Islam. And so they came in, and the Taliban now took over Afghanistan. And in Taliban, then all of a sudden, they implemented a very strict Sharia law. Women could not go to school. You could not fly kites. You could not play Western music. I mean, you could be flogged or killed for these kinds of things. And so they were in the midst of that. And in the midst of that particular action, one of the Taliban leaders, Muhammad Omar, seized power. And that provided a safe haven for Osama bin Laden and the development of the terrorist camps in Afghanistan. Now, you might remember when Bill Clinton was then president in the 1990s, he even launched some missiles into some tents in Afghanistan, thinking he would take out Osama bin Laden. Also launched some into Libya, but in either case did they actually attack those. Well, then now you have Al-Qaeda beginning to become very dominant in the 1990s. Al-Qaeda means the base, and the base of operation was primarily Afghanistan, but then they also began to engage in all sorts of different attacks. You might remember they had attacks in Saudi Arabia. They attacked our embassies in Kenya and Tanzania, and eventually the one that we all remember, of course, 9/11. Then .4, Al-Qaeda became kind of a franchise operation because once we began to attack, they began to decentralize. It's almost like they had franchises, and so you had different ones. And so the leaders in Iraq of Al-Qaeda were Abdul Musab al-Zarqawi. Well, then that brings us to .5, and that is eventually we were able to take out Zarqawi with drone strikes. And that led to the rise of a man by the name of Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. He was the head of the Islamic State of Iraq, and now it's become the Islamic State of Syria and Iraq, and that is known as ISIS. And all of this was happening during the so-called Arab Spring. So let's talk about their theology for just a minute. What do they believe? Well, first of all, they're Sunni Muslims, but in some respects they are very different than other Sunni Muslims that have been our allies. Most Muslims, especially those who are radical, divide the world into two parts. You have those which are the Dar al-Islam, the House of Islam. The other is Dar al-Harb, the House of War. And the argument is the House of Islam are those 57 different countries which are actually Muslim, that are under the control of Islam, many of which have Sharia law. Now, some have more strict Sharia law, like in Nigeria, than you might have, say, in Saudi Arabia. But even there, you have quite a bit of Sharia law. But the idea is the House of War includes nations not under Muslim control and are not submitting to Sharia. So the goal is that eventually there will be a conflict between the House of Islam and the House of War, until eventually the House of War is actually implemented in the House of Islam, and there will be then a worldwide global caliphate, kind of a one-world transnational government in which Sharia law is implemented on everyone. That's the goal. And so you can begin to see how that would be influenced by a caliph. To understand this, you have to understand that when we talk about Sunni Muslims, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi holds to that, and he believes that indeed we will have leaders and that their authority will be universal. Shiites have a much different view in that those in Iran, they do not have imams, they have what? Ayatollahs. Remember Ayatollah Khomeini? Remember that during the 1970s? Now you have Ayatollah Khamenei that are ruling the country. And so as a result, they have a much different kind of view. And so there is a real conflict right now between the Sunni and Shiite. There's some that have suggested, one even on my radio show, that suggests that one of the reasons why perhaps this president has developed a treaty that's not a treaty, a deal on nuclear weapons with Iran, is to strengthen Iran to fight the Sunnis and ISIS. We'll see whether or not that's really the case, but nevertheless, you can roll into this, even the current debate right now about this deal, because it's not a treaty, supposedly, but it is a treaty, but it's not a treaty, the Secretary of State, John Kerry, has negotiated with the leaders of Iran. Here is the leader of ISIS, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. There were some rumors that maybe he had been hit by a drone strike, but it seems like he is still alive. But to give you a little bit of a sense of what he believes, last year, 4th of July, they picked these dates very important. You know, September 11th, I mentioned, 4th of July. Isn't it interesting? He picked the 4th of July last year, and he was proclaimed in the mosque in Mosul, we just talked about that, as the Caliph Ibrahim, the leader of the Islamic State. And he basically said in his speech, "Fear Allah as he should be feared and do not die except as Muslims. Go forth, O Mujahideen." Remember that name? Mujahideen. Those are the people that are fighting in jihad in the path of Allah. Terrify the enemies of Allah and seek death, for the dunya will come to an end and hereafter will last forever. Okay, what's the dunya? Well, the dunya is this world that we're in right now. Just a few weeks ago, remember this individual who went and killed the people in Chattanooga? Remember that individual? And he actually, in his writings, talked about this dunya, this world that we're in right now. He believed that in order to leave this world, this dunya, this false world, and usher in this kingdom, this kind of, if you will, messianic, but it's an Islamic kingdom, that he had thought that killing these military people was part of that function. Do you remember the Boston bombers? One was killed and the other's now been sentenced. They talk about the dunya. So these words show up time and time again. And so it's important to recognize how powerful these are. Which brings me to one of the things that I thought maybe would be worth mentioning, because we're hearing still people saying, you know, the Islamic State is not Islamic. Really? I mean, that's kind of like saying the Pope's not Catholic. I mean, but nevertheless, President Obama said, no religion condones the killing of innocents, and the vast majority of ISIL's victims have been Muslim. Well, true, but that doesn't mean that just because Muslims killing other Muslims doesn't mean that they're not Muslims. Howard Dean a while back said, I've stopped calling these people Muslim terrorists. They're about as Muslim as I am. I mean, they have no respect for anybody else's life. That's not what the Quran teaches. Europe has an enormous radical problem. I think ISIS is a cult, not an Islamic cult, but I think it's a cult. But if you look at the Quran, there are lots of verses that call for Muslims to kill infidels or for other Muslims who are what we would call heretics, who are those who are not following in the path of Allah. Surah 9:5 is known as the verse of the sword. And if you don't believe me, you can go grab a Quran, or you can even find one online, and just go and look at Surah 9, the ninth chapter, and you'll see, for example, chapter 9, verse 5. Surah 9:5 says, fight and slay the pagans wherever you find them, seize them, beleaguer them, and lie in wait for them at every stratagem. If you take that as a literal command that applies to you today, then you can see how you would be a radical Muslim. If you're like a lot of Muslims that we work with every day and see in our community who say, well, that applied in Muhammad's day, but it doesn't apply today, well, they made good neighbors. But if they think that that's a literal command that applies to our 21st century, you don't want them as neighbors, do you? Surah 9:123, fight the unbelievers who gird you about and let them see firmness in you and know that Allah is with you who fear him. Matter of fact, one section of the Quran provides for the killing of qisas. That is for those who might be engaged in any kind of crime. It also, interesting enough, there's a place in the Quran where it tells about Moses following a man who then, out of the blue, just kills this innocent young boy. And Moses, this is in the Quran, not the Bible, by the way, asks, and the man enlightens him by sharing the reason for killing the boy, and that is because he had brought dishonor. And again, we've heard about honor killings up in Denton. We just had an honor killing not so long ago, and we see some of those as well. So these ideas are in the Quran. Now, you can reinterpret them, you can contextualize them, but if you take a literal interpretation of these passages, you can see why we have jihadists today. And ISIS takes one of the most literal interpretations of the Quran of any particular group. Which brings me to my final points, ISIS actions and then how Christians have been affected by that. One of the spokesmen for ISIS, probably one of the better knowns, here's a picture of him, Sheikh Abdul Muhammad al-Adnani. These are all tough names to say, by the way, but nevertheless, has called upon Muslims living in Western countries to find an infidel and smash his head with a rock, poison him, or even destroy his crops. Now, doesn't that strike you as odd? You would think that you would just say, shoot him, right? or behead him. But it says, smash his head with a rock. Well, that's a direct quote from the Quran, which back in the Quran in the 7th century applied. But see, they're still, in some respects, living in the 7th century. They talk about some of the same ways of killing people that happened in the 7th century. Now we're applying it in the 21st century. You know, we've gone through the book of Revelation, haven't we? And a couple of places they talk about all these beheadings. Well, it's only now in the 21st century that all these beheadings might make some sense, because they have revitalized this idea of beheadings. And we've seen, unfortunately, some of them even on YouTube statements. But again, this is the way to motivate them to go back and take a literal interpretation of the Quran and apply that to the battle that they fight against others. As I pointed out, they're not just content with spreading jihad in Iraq, but they've set their sights on larger targets. And one of those is they have threatened to destroy the Kaaba in the Grand Mosque in Mecca. Now, why is that? Because their argument is that that precedes the pure Islam. And even Muhammad was wrong in allowing that to take place. This is a pagan symbol. And so when ISIS comes in, you will see, for example, that they will destroy these museums. You've seen these pictures of them destroying all these artworks. Of course, Johnny talked about destroying and removing every cross and every gravestone in an area. But they also want to go in and destroy Mecca, which is why Saudi Arabia up until now hasn't been all that interested in getting our help to fight off ISIS. But now it's kind of like, you know, this is the number one tourist attraction, by the way, for Saudi Arabia. The hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people that come in to Mecca every single year, and they want to go and destroy it, to level it, shows you their mindset there. You know, we mentioned Johnny Moore, and he today spent most of his time talking about what's happened in the Middle East. But one of the subtitles of that is not only what's happening in the land of the Bible, but what's happening in what? Your own backyard. You know, the first time I interviewed Johnny Moore, we were talking about that hypothetically. The second time I interviewed him, we had just 15 miles from my studio had what happened in Garland, Texas. Remember what happened there? Now, again, I wouldn't have done what Pamela Geller did. I understand that. But nevertheless, here was a situation where two individuals motivated by ISIS come in, and they come out with their AK-47s. And if it were not for the Garland police with a service pistol dropping both of those, I mean, it could have looked in Garland like it did in Charlie Hebdo in Paris. And so, again, we can see what has begun to unfold. FBI Director James Comey has told the National Association of Attorneys General that he says that ISIS is a chaotic spider web that avidly uses social media to radicalize people across the United States. In one point, he said, you know, we had evidence of ISIS in every state but Alaska. And then he said, just recently, we found it in Alaska as well. So he says, now we have investigations of people in various stages of radicalization in all 50 states. He says, this is in all 50 states in ways that are very hard to see. And so he points out, and this comes from also the Steckelbeck book, because he's done a very good job of pulling together from some of the research from the FBI and from some of these intelligence people. And that book is published, by the way, by Regnery, so it's a little more political book. He talks about city wolves. James Comey, FBI director, talks about that. Talks about a network of supporters and sympathizers who are these homegrown jihadists. And I think that's what we're seeing right now. When we see the attack in Garland, we see the attack in Chattanooga, we see some of the foiled attacks in a few other places. These are sometimes lone wolves, or what they call city wolves. But then, recently, in testimony before Congress, the Secretary of Homeland Security, Department of Homeland Security, Jay Johnson, admitted that they actually have a number of individuals that have left this country, fought with ISIS, and then they've returned back. Now, if you believe that they've returned back because they became disillusioned, I do have some land out there in West Texas I want to sell you, because, you know, this, I think these are really dangerous people. And Jay Johnson himself admitted that at least 40 of the estimated 180 who traveled overseas have returned, and they're paying attention to them. A large percentage of them come from a very nice state to live in, Minnesota, but you have an enormous number of population of Somalis that live in Minnesota, and some of them have gone to fight and have come back, so they're watching that. And then, of course, open borders. Have you noticed that conversation taking place over the last couple of weeks? And former CIA officer Brian Fairchild, I've just given you the sort thing there, expressed concern about the fact that even now with our porous borders, a possibility of sneaking biological weapons, chemical weapons, or individuals. You know, a lot of people coming across our border coming here because they want a better life. They want to work here. But you go through some of the backpacks that they're finding, and Border Patrol are finding backpacks with Arabic language in them, Qurans. One, they found the blueprints for a nuclear reactor. Now, maybe you just think they're going to just want to work there at the nuclear reactor, but I think they have some nefarious intents in mind. And there's another good reason why we should pay attention to what's happening at our border. ISIS also using very sophisticated technology. In this particular interview, for those of you that would like to get a copy, he talks a little bit about how it used to be if you wanted to be a jihadist, you would have to go overseas, learn the language, deal with all sorts of real significant issues. But now oftentimes what they're doing is actually communicating online in some of the dark web in your language, and you in your own home can be radicalized right here. And that's the concern James Comey is talking about. He says ISIS is focusing on the uniform military and law enforcement. He said that a couple of weeks ago, and that was before what happened in Chattanooga. And he says he's like the devil sitting on their shoulders saying, kill, kill, kill. When your FBI director's talking like that, I think you should be pretty much concerned. Because I'll be really blunt, right now there's a lot of political correctness in this government. Would everybody agree? Everybody shake your head. Yes. I mean, we have an inability to even talk about who we're fighting right now, and so that is the case. This came from CNN, but a lot of other people reported as well. They've now discovered an ISIS handbook for new recruits. It's in a number of different languages, including the English language, to actually help recruit individuals in this country who are potential radicalized individuals. And so there is even the ISIS handbook. Just before we run out of time, let me talk about persecuted Christians. And at the end, I'm going to say that we need to pray. I'll close this in prayer, and then we can obviously go to lunch. And I'm hoping I didn't ruin your lunch, but at the same time, we need to talk honestly about this as being one of the greatest challenges we as a generation face. What about persecuted Christians? Well, two books that I would recommend if you wanted to read more about the stories of these persecuted Christians. Part of the book by Johnny Moore really tells you the story of some of the people he met in these refugee camps. And another good friend of mine, Tom Doyle, who ministers with me at the Hope Center, he works with A3 Ministries. And his book is called Killing Christians. And he has had an opportunity as the Middle East director for E3 to go to these camps and meet some of the people that are, I think, really the modern day heroes. So these are two really great books. If you wanted to maybe read those, maybe share them with your children, grandchildren, aunts, uncles, nieces, nephews. I mean, they're really great books that I would highly recommend to address those. Of course, Johnny Moore's book's available out there. In his book, for example, these are just a few of our opening chapters, Burn Their Churches and Kill Their Pastors, in which he talks about what is happening in Mosul and now Fallujah. Slaughter them or make their children soldiers, you know, how they're being drafted into kind of a Lord's army, an Allah's army, if you will. Enslave their wives and abuse their daughters and even in the crosses of Anqua. And those are all just the opening chapters in the first third of his book, but then he has whole sections on how we should respond as well. But again, just as we talk about persecuted Christians, the good news is we have been able to document this. Even sometimes if the mainstream media hasn't covered it, we, I think, have done a very good job in the Christian media of covering that and giving you some of that. He mentioned those refugee tents. I don't have a picture of the one with the lighted crosses, but if you look at this, you can see over in the right-hand side there the English word Jesus, but a lot of these you can at least probably make out the crosses and the Arabic. That's pretty bold. You're in a refugee camp and you're saying, you know, even if somebody flies over or there's a sniper in the distance, they can see that, you know, I'm holding up the cross of Jesus. How bold would some of us be I mean, this is pretty amazing. I mean, they're in a refugee camp. And as he said, many of these were people that lived in Mosul. Some lived in Baghdad. Some lived in Fallujah. They lived in relatively middle-class kind of neighborhoods. Many of their kids went off to the University of Baghdad, or maybe some of them were able to get a visa and go to Europe to get a degree, or even to the United States. And to go from your house today to the clothes on your back to living in one of these refugee tents, and then with the one marker that they have to write Jesus, or to write in Arabic, or to put a picture of the cross. It's pretty challenging, isn't it? And again, he told the story, I don't have that picture, but of the cross, and not only put up a cross, but then put lights around it so from a distance you can see that that's a Christian refugee camp. You know, I had some people actually say, well, are these people all Christians? I'm thinking so. You know, if you were just a little bit, you know, questioning about whether or not you wanted to be a Christian, you know, I don't think I'd be putting the cross up very high, right? You know, if you just weren't sure about where you stood about Jesus, I don't think you're in this camp, right? I don't think you're putting up with all of that. I think it's pretty clear. But I still get those questions when I open up on radio. Another book, I mentioned Tom Dole's book, you know, The Pirates of Somalia. It talks about this one individual that had been part of the pirates. You know, these people are becoming Christians. Tom Dole's earlier book was about dreams and visions, about all the Muslims that are seeing dreams and visions, and then they meet a Christian, become a Christian. The Empty Grave in Syria, Get Your Bible at the Mosul, The Joy of Baghdad Beating. I mean, again, there's some just really great material in some of these books. So the good news is, I think some Christians are really raising the issue. The bad news is, I love this one. Where's the Pope's encyclical on Christian persecution? The Pope just recently did a really thick encyclical on what? Global warming. I would suggest to you that global warming is not the great threat in the 21st century. I know I can get myself in a lot of trouble on some secular talk shows when I say that, but I don't think global warming is the problem in the 21st century. And yet that was the latest encyclical from the Pope. What should we be talking about? Christian persecution. Which is why I'm glad that we have people like Johnny Moore. How should Christians respond to ISIS? This is a good article in Christian Post. And if you say, well, okay, how can I respond? There are lots of things we can do. But since I'm noticing that the time is getting away from me, I'll just give you a couple of suggestions. The first suggestion is we need to pray. And I'll close in prayer in just a minute. But the verse that Johnny Moore put out there today, 2 Thessalonians 3:2, tells us to pray that we may be delivered from wicked and evil men. Now, when I've had a privilege occasionally of interviewing somebody that's been a persecuted Christian, you know what some of them say? Don't pray that I will be delivered. Pray that I will sustain and be bold in the midst of it. I think most of us would pray, Lord, protect us from the evildoers. But some of them are simply saying, well, if they're going to come, pray that I will be faithful to the end. Is that powerful? So certainly, if I can encourage you even this week to pray that some of them may indeed be delivered from wicked and evil men, that is certainly something to do. Second of all, one of the things that we have done at Point of View, and you can go anywhere you want, is the Cradle Fund. It was established by Johnny Moore. It was established and now organized by a fellow Southern Baptist. So you know they believe in the gospel. You know they're orthodox in terms of their beliefs. But it turns out that this is a Southern Baptist. I won't say his name, although you can find it on the website, who has had very good connections with the United Nations. So they've been able to get into the camps and they've been able to that. So we were able to raise $50,000, and that all went to help them, in some cases, have beds to sleep on, pillows to use, warm clothes, because some of them just had the clothes on their back, provide some of the food, and so that is one. Or if you just want to help any of the groups that are out there helping martyrs, that would be Samaritan's Purse, that would be Open Doors, be Voice of the Martyrs, something I think you can do. And again, don't take away from the gifts you give to this church in terms of your tithe and offerings, but at the same time, I think this is our great challenge. And as Johnny said, you know, we weren't around during the Holocaust. There was nothing we could do about what happened in the past. But we are here now. This is our challenge now. Some people have said this is our Auschwitz now. What are we going to do? And I think there's some things we can do. Again, for those of you that are new to the class, if you weren't here in May when I spoke on this and made available, this is the CD that was from the May 6th interview I did with Johnny Moore. So if you said, I'd like to know a little bit more. He did a really good job in 35 minutes, but we covered in an entire hour some other things he didn't cover. So I will leave those available. So let our visitors and new attendees get them first. And if there's any extras, you can take them and use them as well. That's my free gift to you. But let us close in prayer. And then after that, we'll be dismissed. We'll see you down there for lunch. Let's pray. Father, when we think about our brothers and sisters in the Lord in these refugee camps, we are just humbled to realize what we enjoy in our freedom and our affluence here. And I pray, Father, that that would humble us enough to pray at least on a regular basis for those persecuted Christians. Father, I do pray for them that you indeed would protect them from wicked and evil men. For those who are in difficult situations, that you would sustain them. And I pray, Father, your blessings most importantly upon Johnny Moore and those who work with him, that you would keep them safe so that they might be able to deliver and minister, to give more than just a cup of cold water, but to provide all the resources that so many of these families need. And we do pray that there may be a day when ISIS is no more and some of these individuals might be able to go back into the biblical homeland, the places where Jonah was, the places where Paul ministered, the places where Thomas, the first apostle, brought the gospel. And so we pray for that as well. And finally, Father, as we are in the midst of an election year, I pray that we might, as a country, make wise decisions about who our next leader might be, because this will be a great challenge, and he or she will have to face those. And I pray that we might sustain those individuals, that we might make good decisions about who to elect, and that we might pray for those in authority. We thank you for the blessings of this church. We thank you for Johnny Moore and his tremendous ministry. And we pray now for your blessings upon the rest of our day and the coming week, and pray this in Christ's name. Amen.